Hello, my name is Shane Chebsey and this is The Icecast. This week's episode of The Icecast is sponsored by artist Faze Chan. Faze Chan is a Gloucester-based artist and illustrator who specialises in high-contrast black and white inking. She loves to draw fantasy and horror art, and her favourite subject matters are birds, dragons and sea monsters. She works both traditionally and digitally and has plenty of handmade items available in her online shop, including prints, enamel pins and t-shirts. You can find her art on Instagram, Twitter, Etsy and Twitch. Just search Faze Chan. That's P-H-A-S-E-C-H-A-N with an exclamation mark. Thank you so much, Faze, for your support of the show. And now, without further ado, here is episode 5 of The Icecast. Good evening and welcome to The Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on The Icecast we talk to comic creators, writers and publishers about their work, their influences and everything in between. And this evening I am joined, I'm very happy actually to be joined by the one and only Mr. Ron Friends. Good afternoon, I believe it is for you, Ron.
It is afternoon here, Shane. Yes, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for asking me.
Oh, it's an honour, mate. It's an honour, really. First of all, thank you again for coming on. And I'd like to begin at the beginning, I guess, because my first sort of encounter with your work was when you were on Amazing Spider-Man with Tom DeFalco. And I think a lot of people probably listen to this. That's probably their first encounter as well. But you started with Marvel a little bit earlier than that, didn't you?
A little bit, yes. It was all very quick. It was very, very much a feeling of being thrown in on the deep end. I had shown samples to the then editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter. He is also a native of my same hometown, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, right.
He was doing a shop appearance there, and I had several really good friends who were being very supportive and said, if you don't show them your samples, we're going to show them your samples, type of thing. So I, along with a few other people that I didn't know, were, you know, took the opportunity to have him flip through some Xeroxes of our work. And he liked it enough that he wanted to take the Xeroxes with him. And at one point, as he was leaving, he turned to me and said, and I guess I'll be talking to you about work. And I went, oh, wow, that would be great if it were that easy. It wasn't. I never heard anything. I tried calling his office a few times, but of course, if you call the editor-in-chief's office saying it's about work,
yeah,
then suddenly he's traveling or he's unavailable. You know that.
Yeah.
So that was disappointing. But in the meantime, I got a job at a local animation studio. We worked on local and regional animation spots for advertising for commercials.
Oh, right. So that's where you cut your teeth. That's where you sort of learned the business end of things then.
Right out of art school, that's what I ended up doing. I ended up doing some character design, storyboarding and some cell painting and, you know, the grunt work because, you know, I made it very clear to the editor, my boss at the animation studio, a gentleman named Rick Catazone, he knew how, from my portfolio, he knew how directed I was to do comics.
Yeah.
And he actually took me out to lunch and said, now, if I take the time to train you and Marvel crooks their finger, are you going to pick up and leave me? And I was quiet. And he said, this is the point where Ron, where you say, no, Rick, I would never do that to you.
And it just didn't come out. It just didn't come out that way.
I said, believe me, that is not my intention. So what ended up happening was I worked at Marvel, I worked at the animation studio, I guess about a year before Marvel called.
Oh, so they just called you up out of the blue? Were you still chasing work? Were you still sending in samples?
Well, I was working 9 to 5 at the animation studio, and I was still living with my parents. So my mom called me at the animation studio and said, somebody named Al Milgram is trying to get a hold of you from Marvel, and he left this number. So I said, okay. And again, Rick was very supportive. So I called Al Milgram. He handed the phone to Louise Jones, who is now Louise Simonson.
Mm-hmm.
And she offered me my first Kesar job. Mm. And my intent at that time was to do whatever work I could do for Marvel without compromising my work at the studio. Because when work was slow at the studio, Rick was willing to let me work in the office on Marvel stuff.
So that's really decent.
Yeah. So the situation was, you know, was very amenable and everything. I was still working at home, of course, at times. There, whenever we were busy at the studio, I'd work, you know, there were a couple of times on deadlines at the studio that I'd be working, you know, 12 hours at the animation studio and come home and still have to produce some pages to send off to Marvel. So it got a little weird and it got a little intense at times. Mm-hmm. But that only lasted for a couple of years because when they offered me Spider-Man. In the meantime, I had done K-Sar. I was regular on K-Sar for a while. Spider-Man appeared in K-Sar. Mm. So Tom DeFalco offered me some Marvel team-up jobs. And for a very brief time that it doesn't really seem to register in the way the books were published, I was a regular artist on Marvel team-up.
Yeah.
And from there, I did fill in Spectacular Spider-Man. I did The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. And I was asked by Danny Fingeroth to come on the Spider-Man title. Initially, it was only for 6 issues.
Yeah.
But when I was offered Spider-Man, and the work was coming fast and furious for Marvel, when I was offered that 6 months on Spider-Man, that was when I sat down with my boss at the animation studio and said, you know.
You took the plunge, basically.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna do it. He was not surprised at all.
Yeah.
So
he knew that's where your passion lay.
He never knew otherwise, really. he was never gonna turn me into an animation geek, you know.
And that was John Romita, wasn't it? John Romita was doing was it John Romita Sr. or Jr. that was doing...
John Romita Jr. and Roger Stern were wrapping up their run. Mm. Roger Stern was leaving for one reason or another, and Romita Jr. was going to take over X-Men.
That's it.
But the original deal was he was going to take 6 months off of Spider-Man to get X-Men on schedule, and then he was going to do... If you can imagine, he was going to do The Amazing Spider-Man and X-Men.
Whoa.
At a time when books were actually paying royalties on sales. Yeah. That would have set him up wonderfully, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Not that he ever had a problem. But from what I understand from Danny Fingeroth, at one point, J.R. Jr. came into the office. And Danny said, well, we're going to stick with the plan if we're still going to do the plan, right? And JR said, well, it's been pretty intense on X-Men trying to get it on schedule. So you seem to be happy with these guys. You know, let them have it. And the first time I met John Romita Jr., I thanked him for my run on Spider-Man because it was a nod from him that put me on the book regularly with DeFalco. And of course, I had worked briefly with Tom as an editor on Team Up.
Yeah.
And one or two other fill-ins. But once we started working together as writer and artist, I mean, obviously it was a partnership that worked for both of us. So,
I mean, it worked for the fans as well. I mean, that was such a favorite run. I mean, for myself, for a lot of my friends at the time, I remember picking up that stuff up, you know, and it was just, you guys, you were really creative at that time. You were coming up with new characters, you know, like Puma.
That was one of Tom's edicts. He didn't, as much as I wanted to do Spider-Man since I was, you know, 6 or 7. I wanted to grow up and do Spider-Man someday. So when I got there, well, one, we had the black costume, which was...
Yeah.
As soon as I got there, they got rid of the red and blue suit for a while. and I was working with a writer who had no intention of using the classic characters. He said, we're gonna try to contribute to the Rogues Gallery and everything. He wanted us to come up with as much original stuff as possible. So for the 2.5 years we were on it, it's very flattering that people remember it as fondly as they do, because in the overall scheme of things, we were on it for 2.5 years. I mean, we've been off and on associated with the book along the way.
Mm.
Tom did a whole separate run as a writer without me, which to this day hurts very deeply.
Oh, got you there.
But, and then, of course, Spider-Girl, you know.
Yeah.
Reconnect with those characters through Spider-Girl.
I mean, did Spider-Girl come around because you wanted to rekindle that sort of creative flow with Tom?
Well, again, as much, you know, as I'll give Tom credit for all the original, you know, for the original characters we developed together. And on Spider-Girl, that was something. I was over at DC doing Superman, and he had become the, again, the regular writer on the new What If, and he was, you know, coming up with ideas fast and furious. And one of the ideas that had never, that had always kind of haunted him was from the Clone Saga.
Yeah.
Jane actually having the kid and all this. And that was something he really wanted to explore. And he invited me to develop it with him. And so we did 105. And we were shocked at how popular it seemed to get. You know, I mean, that the office was interested in doing, going to series with it and doing, you know, other MC2 projects. And I mean, it was something that surprised us.
I mean, do you think it was a different audience that picked up Spider-Girl?
Well, I think Spider-Girl hit a sweet spot. I think Spider-Girl hit a very kind of a hunger in the audience, in that it was a legacy title, but Pete was still very much a part of it.
Yeah.
So the longtime Spider-Man fans were finally getting a Spider-Man who had aged with them and was, you know, experiencing the same things they were experiencing. And the new fans now had a second generation Spider person to call their own. Mm-hmm. And that you don't get that a lot. Usually, if you do a legacy character, you're dealing with the original character died or, you know, is embittered and dark and all this kind of stuff. And we really very much wanted to do a positive future where the Marvel heroes actually had a positive impact on society.
Yeah, and I think that was a different take, you know, because, you know, at that time we were still sort of reeling, weren't we, from all the dark and gritty stuff and Batman and things like that.
And Tom and I are always going to run opposite that. I mean, we like to have our heroes smiling, and we like to create characters that you actually want to spend time with.
Yeah.
Because when you think about it, if you're asking them to spend money to check in once a month, you would think it would be with people you enjoy, you know, people you like. Set an example. You know,
and you can relate to as well. I think a lot of, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think a lot of female readers probably related to the character more so than they would have done, you know, in the past. I think you probably picked up, because it was a really healthy title, wasn't it, for a long time? And I think there was this core readership that stuck with it.
It survived. The core readership was incredibly faithful. It stuck around for, 13, 14 years in one form or another. And it always foiled the Marvel salespeople, because, you know, Tom tells the stories about how we were scheduled to be canceled like every 6 or 8 issues, because the sales department, you know, books only go down in sales when you're selling through the comic book retail market.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they order big on the first issue, they see how that goes, and then every time they have a book left on the racks, they don't see that as a good thing because they're working order to order.
Yeah.
So they cut their orders. So, you know, they cut their order almost at least an issue or two every month, to the point that you're not selling anymore.
Yeah.
But Spider-Girl held a line. You know, every time they did their math and came up with, you're going to be canceled at issue 16 or 30 or whatever it was, we were always still holding that solid line, and they would go, okay, well, then let's do 8 more, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we kept chugging along. But yeah, we had very smart fans. I mean, at one point they ran a campaign not to write to Marvel and complain, but to write to retailers and say, if you order this book, we will support it. You should order this book. It's a great book. If you order it, they will come, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, which was amazing for the time. I mean, it was, and I can't tell you how flattering and humbling it is.
I bet. It must be really nice to know that so many people
are that enthusiastic, that they enjoy the character and enjoy the work that much. I mean, at one point on the Spider-Girl message board years ago, they offered to do a Kickstarter. They wanted to, they were willing to finance the book.
Oh.
To pay Tom and I to do it. And, you know, and Tom got on there and said, please, no, we're not going to do that. we're already taking your money. We're not gonna expect you to finance the title.
Yeah, that's up to Marvel.
Yeah, but they were. That's how enthusiastic they were about the character.
And yeah, I mean it's a shame in a way that it's a Marvel character and it's not a Tom DeFalco, Ron Frenz character. As in,
exactly.
You guys owned it.
But that's the thing. The reason that the Spider-Girl character survived more so than the other MC2 characters is because it's Spider-Man. It's,
yeah.
Pete was still in the book. I swear, almost every editor we had, with very notable exceptions, when they would come on the book, they would want to either kill Pete, kill Mary Jane,
really?
or move Mayday to the 616. Mm. And any one of those things would have killed the book.
Yeah. It wouldn't be special anymore. I mean, it was different. It had its own little family
aspect and the legacy aspect. Then I think you were just killing what was popular about the book.
Yeah.
And no surprise, of course, when a different writer finally got a chance to write her in what was it called, Spider-Verse?
I think it was part of Spider-Verse, wasn't it?
Yeah, Spider-Verse. The first thing they did was kill Pete. I mean, and everybody was like, can you believe they did that? And I went, absolutely, I can believe they did that, because almost every editor we ever had wanted to do that, So that didn't surprise us at all. But, I mean, by the time they were all done with Spider-Geddon, everything was back to normal anyway. So if in some stretch of the imagination we're ever invited back to do Spider-Girl, we'll start from where they left us and keep going. But
It sort of diverged anyway, didn't it? So if you wanted to, you could easily pick up where you left off. And
oh, very much so.
Tom
is a complete and total pro. He's a structure guy. One of the reasons I like working with him is it's not about either one of our egos. It's not about, this idea is better than that idea. It's about what serves the story and what serves the characters. And he is a bit of a teacher in him. If he doesn't think an idea will work, it doesn't become a personal thing. He'll explain to you why he doesn't think the idea works.
Yeah.
And if there's something I really want to do, I'll bring it up 6 months later. I'll bring it up another 6 months later, and
keep pushing it.
And often what we'll do is we'll end up like adapting it so that it does work.
That sounds like a very healthy working relationship.
Right. Oh, you can't be precious with your ideas. No. Tom and I both kind of see our job as being idea machines. Mm. And if you only have, and I believe me, I know some professional guys who working in the industry who have like six ideas a year and guard them preciously and, become very defensive about them and all of this. And that is no way to survive in this industry long term. I mean, you have to be willing to take ideas from anybody. You have to be willing to work with people, and you have to be willing to see your idea evolve or adapt to whatever the circumstance is.
I think it's part of being a professional, isn't it?
It is. I think so. And Tom thinks that way, and so we have. We've always had that in common, and it's made it a wonderful. He's a terrific friend, and
And you guys are still you guys are still in touch. You still
sure? Yeah, I just talked to him a couple of years ago. He goes out of his way to stay in touch, even though we're not working together. And whenever an opportunity presents itself, we pretty much take it if we can.
So, and what your working process? Did you? I mean, did Tom sort of come up with a full script, or was it more the sort of the old Marvel way of working where?
It was definitely more like old Marvel.
Yeah.
Tom always produced a plot. A plot. And the plot was usually the result of long phone conversations that two adult men should not be having about fictional characters. We would talk about Peter, and we'd talk about his life and where he's at and how he feels about this situation and how he feels about that situation. Tom would structure a plot from those conversations, and we'd kind of run from there. I would sit with it a little longer while I was penciling it, and I would put in little liner notes, and if I had little ideas along the way, I'd pass them along to him, and so it would continue to evolve. But Tom, as I said, being a structure guy, he always knew clearly what the theme was. He would actually put it at the top of his the first page.
Right.
The theme for this issue is, and everything served that theme. And yeah, that's one of the reasons I think he's such an enjoyable writer. I'm a big fan of his because his work is always very clean and clear. And
yeah, the plotting is always really good.
Solid stories with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you get payoff. You know, I mean, we did some of these Thor epics that the way he would keep track of everybody's character arc and the way he would keep track of how much room to give, you know, each beat of the story was always just amazing to watch.
Yeah. And was working on Thor, I assume the similar process. I don't suppose there was much different between Spider-Man and Thor in the way you worked.
Well, they're visually more than anything, because structure-wise, you know, it was melodrama and it was soap opera. And, you know, that's the thing. We would talk about the characters. Our intention from the time we introduced Eric Masterson was to do what we did with him, but it was a very slow burn. We were in no hurry to get there.
Right.
Because luckily, if you're working at Marvel and your sales are solid and the editor's happy with what you're doing, it was a different time back then.
You had leeway. You could pretty much do what you liked.
The book wasn't in danger of being canceled every 6 months like it is. Nobody was just doing 6-issue arcs. So that's why we did 7 years on Thor, because Ralph Macchio was our editor. He liked what we were doing. We kept challenging ourselves and trying to have fun. Eric Masterson, introducing Eric was part of that. Mm. And we always figured that if we're having fun, the reader will have fun.
Definitely. And that was a really fun run on Thor. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The art for me as well was just so full of energy. I mean, your work is just all about movement, power, energy, character.
That's very nice. Thank you.
It's all in there.
I learned from the best. I've always been
who was your mentor then? Who was the person who sort of took your hand and said, here we go, or was it some more of a remote thing? Was there someone?
It was always more of a remote thing. The closest thing I have to a mentor in comics would have been DeFalco, as far as hands-on. Joe Duffy, I got to work with her on Star Wars before I started my partnership with Tom, and that was also a wonderful partnership, because the mutual respect was there, and you know, the respecting of the respective disciplines. You know, I mean, she's a terrific writer. I let her structure the story. I'm not there to make waves, and I try to serve her story as best I can. And
because that was quite early on as well for you, Star Wars, wasn't it? Was that?
After.
After Kazar, was it?
It was after Kazar, but it was through the same office and everything. Yes.
Right.
But yeah, that was after Kazar, but also for Louise Jones. She was editing that title as well before marrying Walt Simonson. And so it was all within the same office. Kesar, the Indiana Jones fill-ins I did.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So that was all the same office. And so I was going to ask how that came about.
My first couple of years were all through Louise's office. Yes. Mm. Like I said, she hired me. She was first to hire me for these Kesar fill-ins. She liked what I was doing.
Yeah.
Pretty early on, it was kind of decided that I would do breakdowns, because they liked my storytelling, and they wanted to use me as much as they could in that capacity. So other opportunities arose. The Indiana Jones was written by David Michelinie, and it was originally a single issue, and it was so jam-packed. I started thumbnailing it, and I called Louise, and I said, Louise, I honestly, truthfully do not think I can fit all of this in a single issue.
When I saw those books, I remember thinking that must have been a challenge to sort of plot that out visually, because there's so much going on. It really is quite an action-packed story.
It just didn't. That story did not lend itself to a single issue.
No.
And when I mentioned it to Louise, she went, "Well, okay, that's no problem. I'll talk to David, and we'll get it worked out." So he restructured it for 2 issues. And put in a few extra scenes to bridge the 2 issues. So I got 2 issues out of it instead of 1. I wish I could say that was my plan from the beginning, but it wasn't. And it was fun. You know, I mean, I once I started working with writers I had read and admired, because my first gig on K-Star was working with Bruce Jones.
All right.
Bruce Jones was not a typical Marvel writer. He would write these wonderful little short stories that, you know, all the information you needed was there, but he
didn't it wasn't formed like a plot or a script. It was just a story outline.
Exactly. It was just, he was basically telling a little short story, and I was working off of that. And I think once they saw that I could handle that, they had very little question that I could handle a more traditional Marvel plot. But once I, you know, whenever I would get a chance to work with like, you know, a guy like Dave Michelinie or Bill Mantlow, I worked with on a couple of fill-ins and on the Marvel team-up stuff that I did.
Yeah,
it was wonderful because, you know, again, then I'm right where I want to be. You know, I wanted to be a Marvel guy since I was
like a kid in a sweet shop.
Exactly.
I mean, you were very lucky, I guess, to work with some of these great writers and also some good inkers as well with your stuff.
Oh, I've been incredibly lucky with that.
Yeah.
I entered the industry with the attitude that it's a collaborative medium. I had never really trained myself with the tools of inking. I was hired primarily as a penciler and a storyteller, and I really don't have much of an ambition. I'm only now getting kind of proficient as an inker for my private commissions and such.
Right. Yeah.
It was a very, for me, it was, let's go. Let's bring me in, use me however you want to use me as a storyteller and a penciler. And I was ready to go. You know, I was ready to work with whoever you wanted to pair me with, and let's go, you know, and, it worked out for me.
Great choices, you know. I mean, Joe Rubenstein, I believe, inked you a few times. And obviously the great Joe Sinnott, you know.
When I had worked with him on What If, a Fantastic Four What If, pretty early on. He inked the figures, and I mean that those are the moments where you're like, holy crap, I'm a Marvel guy. You really feel, I mean, I got to work with Tom Palmer on Star Wars.
Yeah.
Spider-Man 252 rolls around, and for a reason neither one of us remember, Brett Breeding was called in to ink that issue, you know, even though he wasn't the regular guy on Spider-Man. I mean, but then again, neither was I really, you know. So, it was incredible. Yeah, it was just an incredible opportunity. And every incident just kind of reinforced this idea for me that where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the thick of it. I wanted to be in the trenches producing for Marvel Comics. And I've never been happier than when I was doing that. Our 7-year run on Thor, I woke up every morning knowing that these were going to be the good old days.
Yeah, I mean, and you saw that in this. I mean, unashamedly, your style is sort of retro, isn't it? I mean, for want of a better expression.
I'll embrace that. If that's how somebody sees it, that's fine. I have no desire. I shamelessly have no desire to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
I did not want to come into this industry and show everybody what they were doing wrong in comics. You know. I very much love the comics of the late 60s and early 70s, and that's the stuff I grew up on.
Yeah.
And it affected me deeply, and my ambition is no more than to try to entertain an audience over the course of my career as much as I was entertained by the stuff I was reading.
And I think a lot of the fans, especially those sort of my generation who were reading, you know, Thor and Spider-Man in our sort of, I guess I was in my late teens. Yeah, we appreciated that. We saw that love and that respect for the great artists that have gone before in your work.
That's certainly what it is. Yeah, that's certainly what it is. And that, and my desire not to do anything other than to serve the character You know, whereas Tom will do that through his scripts and through his stories and through our stories, my way of doing that was in going back to visually what made that character unique. Mm-hmm. And for Spider-Man, that meant studying Ditko. And for Thor, it meant studying Kirby. And, you know, making the character look like the character you're picturing in your head when you think.
Yeah, and your Spider-Man very much harked back to Ditko, I felt, because, you know, after Ditko, there's a lot of artists who drew him very muscular, very, you know, big guy. Whereas when you drew him, he was skinny again. And that's the way I always liked him.
In all fairness, I mean, Rich Buckler was already doing a Ditko riff on Peter Parker, I believe.
Yeah.
But when I was awarded the Kid Who Collects Spider-Man plot, and I read through it, and it became obvious that there was not a lot of action in it, you know, that Spider-Man had to be Spider-Man just standing in the room talking to the kid.
Yeah.
And the best way for that to happen was to not have it be a Ron Frenz figure in a Spider-Man costume, but to pull out my Ditko reference and try to make it as much, give it as much the feel of a Steve Ditko figure as possible. Mm. So that's what I did. And it worked. It worked in that instance. And again, it was, you know, you want to go back because every character suffers to one extent or another from the creative game of telephone. Okay. Mm. Each new creator, if you're only working off of the one creator or the two creators that came before you, you're doing a disservice to the character as the timeline moves along.
Yeah.
So my desire and my attitude about it was, no, you go back to the guy that developed the character. Go back to see what the original intent of Spider-Man or Thor or any of those characters were that made them worth doing, that made them unique from every other character up to that point.
Mm.
And try to get a handle on that, try to get a hook into that, and you know, and then go your own way with it, you know.
Yeah.
but understand what it is about the way Spider-Man moves or the way Thor walks or handles his hammer or whatever that was original to the initial creator.
Yeah, because those old creators, you know, those guys, they did a lot of, their storytelling had a lot of character acting, didn't it?
Sure. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And everything was deliberate.
Mm.
I mean, one of the more irritating aspects of the comics industry is working with anchors and colorists and everything, is that you can occasionally find somebody that, you know, is working on your pencils and doesn't maintain the intent of expression or a panel or a movement or a scene.
That must be frustrating as well, because you know exactly what you want and it's not there anymore.
It can be incredibly frustrating, especially and really only if it affects the storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, everything else is subjective, you know, but whether or not the story is told as well as it can be, that's objective. You know, you either tell the story well or you don't.
Mm.
You know? But everything else along the way, you know, is subjective, and the reader is only seeing the one version. So again, you pack your ego, and you know you're going to be working with other incredibly talented people, and you recognize that and move on to the next job. You know,
yeah,
that's the only healthy way. Unless, of course, you're going to be one of these guys that's going to write and draw and ink and
do everything. Yeah.
You know, in which case, God love you. That was never going to be me. But God love you if you're able to do all of that yourself.
I think for some people, you know, they need that control over what they're creating, don't they? They want to do everything, just to have control over it.
Yeah, but, I feel a little sorry for them because they're missing out on a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Because creative people are fun people, and working creatively with a group of people gives you different points of view. And it's like you also need to get out and live a life so that you have things to reference in your work, you know.
Yeah.
In the same way you need to do that, you need to live a life to have a story, to have stories to tell and to have a point of view. You also need to, you know, to work with other people, you're finding out about other points of view and you're finding out about other ways to do things. And during the time I shared, I was fortunate enough to share studio space, physical studio space with Pat Olive.
All right.
Just an incredible illustrator.
Yeah.
And an incredible professional and a terrifically nice guy. And, you know, during the time that he and I were sharing studio space, I think my work improves immensely because I could bounce things off of him and get opinions from him, but also just watching him work was
crucial.
So
it can be inspiring, can't it? You know, working closely with another artist, especially somebody who you admire, you know, it just,
it's almost imperative that, I mean, everything I'm talking about has everything to do with working with people you respect. Now, you have to be objective about it, okay? Everybody's not going to do everything exactly the way you would do it.
No.
But if you respect them, that's the best way to go. I mean, there was no way that, I mean, you know, all my respect for Tom DeFalco was front-loaded. I mean, when he became the editor of the Spider-Man titles, as I was a fan reading them, mm-hmm. and it was announced that Tom DeFalco would be the editor of the Spider-Man titles, I'm like, who the heck is Tom DeFalco? They're giving all Spider-Man titles to some jamoke kid that just came over from the Archie comics? Oh, my God! You know, that guy. But that run by Roger Stern and John Romita Jr. was some of the best stuff that Spider-Man ever saw.
It was incredible. All the Hobgoblin stuff, you know.
And Tom has to get some credit for that, you know. And I'm like, well, I guess, what did I know? You know, that kind of thing. And when I got to meet Tom and when he hired me to do Team Up and we would have conversations, we met in person fairly early on at a convention here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, we chatted and found out that we enjoyed the same kind of Marvel Comics and the same era of Marvel Comics. And, and we're looking to have the same, you know, the same impact, the same kind of fun as we were working in comics and became fast friends. And that just enhanced our professional relationship, you know? So, but yeah, I certainly everything I said about collaboration is dependent on respecting the people, but sometimes you have to, sometimes you need to stand back and observe and be objective about how good somebody is in something too. You know, a quick story. I was called, it is several years ago now, but it was, at my alma mater high school, I was asked to come in and do a quick talk. They were forming this comic book club.
Right.
But they weren't just collectors. They were going to do this big project where they were going to break off into creative teams.
Right.
And there would be like, you know, five or six people in the creative team. One person would be an editor. One person would be a writer. One person would be a penciler. One person would be an anchor. One person would be a color as a letter.
So they were emulating the process that they'd seen.
They were trying to emulate the process. And then each group would produce their comic. And, you know, and then it would all, they'd all come back together to share their comics with each other and, you know, it would be this wonderful exchange of creative
great.
Energy. It did. It sounded great.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it never actually happened.
All right.
and as far as I know, let's make that very clear. I was never invited back to see the finished products.
Oh.
So I'm assuming it never happened.
Yeah.
If it didn't happen, I have a fairly decent idea why. Because my original presentation was all thrown out the window because they broke into groups, they made assignments, and they decided who was going to be what in the team and everything. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, Shane, kids were coming up to me and saying, well, what if I don't like his story? What if he doesn't write what I want to draw?
All right.
What if he doesn't, you know? And I said, well, that's what the editor is for. Well, what if I don't agree with the editor?
Oh.
And it was just, oh my God. I could not believe how quickly the creative ego.
Yeah, just destroyed the process.
Into these kids. Yeah. I mean, they were just kids. So my talk to them was about, listen to me. You're going to learn from each other at the same time you're having creative fun. So if somebody gives you something to draw that isn't what you want to draw, that's a challenge.
Mm. It's a chance to improve, isn't it? It's a chance to grow as an artist.
It's a chance to get outside of just drawing what you want to draw and draw something that you're being required to draw. I said, plus the fact, you know, maybe that other person has some really good ideas, you know, and it's something you'll find yourself really enjoying doing. So do it. I said, because if you're the problem, if something backs up on you and you're the one that doesn't want to work with the other people and everything, then you're the problem.
Yeah, you become the bad cog in the wheel.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't become the toothless cog.
That's the one.
You need to keep that wheel turning, you know, that kind of thing. I said that if you have any hope, if you have any desire or dream to actually work in this industry, then have some fun with it, you know.
Yeah.
It can be fun if you let it be fun, but it was stunning to me how these junior, what would they have been, like ninth graders or something like that.
Right.
Ninth, just.
And they'd already had huge egos.
Immediately the creative ego inserted itself. Yeah. It was stunning to me, just stunning.
And obviously there are some huge egos in the comic industry. There always have been.
I guess that was bound to happen as comic fans became comic professionals. You know, I think that was a product of that.
Yeah. Their perception of themselves as they became professionals was their perception that they had of the people they admired.
Right. Right. And you know, here you see criticism of gentlemen like Sal Buscema, or John Buscema, or even Romita to a certain extent. They were just hacking it away. They were just looking for a paycheck. And it's like, we're all just looking for a paycheck. I got news for you guys. That doesn't mean that they weren't, committed to the work and doing the best work they could under the circumstances that they were doing. You know, I mean, Sal Buscema especially went through a long period in his career where he was considered the company hack. And, you know, when people would occasionally level that at me, I'm like, that's a compliment. If you're going to call Sal Buscema a hack, if you're going to call me a hack,
being in the same sort of league as Sal Buscema, man.
That's right. I will stand proudly beside Sal Buscema holding the hack flag. You know, that guy, if you think that guy's a hack and you're comparing me to his output and his work and his ability, then nothing but flatter.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I remember that run he did on the Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man.
Even the stuff when he was, you know, doing those inventory fill-in stories where he was recapping people's origins and they would throw an anchor on there that might not have served the art as well as others. But I mean, his contribution was always spot on. His storytelling is incredible. And one of the great pleasures, the great pleasure of my career has been, in general, has been that I can call Sal Buscema a friend. I was able to call Mr. Joe Sinnott a friend, as well as a colleagues, and you know, which is for me, you know, was
that's special, isn't it?
This day, it gives me
to
think that you know I worked with these gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean that's something that is always going to stay with you, you know, forever, isn't it?
I've said several times, if it all went away tomorrow, you throw dirt on me, but I'll have a smile on my face. How many kids can say that they ended up doing at 25 what they said they wanted to do when they were 6 or 7?
That's the mark of success as far as I'm concerned, is doing what you love for a living.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's nothing to do with how much you earn or anything like that. It's if you can do what you love and make a living out of it,
absolutely.
What more can you ask from life?
Right. And there was a friend of mine coming out of art school, a gentleman that I met in art school, that he actually at one point, I guess, did the math and decided, when you think about it, when you think about how many people want to get into the industry and how many, or the profession and how many people are actually in the profession. He said the comics industry at the point that I got in was more exclusive than like the NBA. So it was like, okay. I mean, I'm never going to do that math.
It's
okay.
An interesting comparison.
I feel like it's a dream come true. You know, yeah. I told these kids when I did that presentation, I said, whenever I would do school talks, I would say, you know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Your dad may think he's the luckiest guy in the world, but you go home today and you could say, Dad, you're not the luckiest guy in the world. I just met the luckiest guy in the world. Because he was watching the Spider-Man cartoon in 1967 and dreamed of growing up and drawing Spider-Man, and he was doing it at 25. You know,
it's amazing, isn't it? That cartoon spans the generations. I think
it really does. That was because I wasn't even watching it on Saturday morning. I was watching it in syndication.
Yeah, at like
7 a.m. on weekday mornings. My brother and I would watch it while we were eating our cereal before school. And yeah, it was one of my first exposures to Spider-Man.
Me too. I
had a chance to meet Mr. Paul Soles, who played the voice of Spider-Man and Peter Parker.
All right.
At a convention not all that long ago. And I got to shake his hand and tell him, I said, you know, not only was it my first exposure to the character and helped spark my love of the character, but, you know, 25 years later, I was actually working on the character and I've had a chance to contribute to the character. And
in a major way as well.
I wanted to say thank you. And it was very well. He was a terrific guy. It was wonderful.
Yeah. I'll bet that was a great experience to meet someone like that.
I mean, I've met Stan Lee. I've hung around. I spent some time with Stan after having a chance to work with him. So he actually knew who I was. And things like that. That was terrific. I mean, I got to meet John Buscema in Tom DeFalco's office. Mm. So he wasn't on, you know, he wasn't giving a lecture and he wasn't playing the grumbly professional guy.
He was just chewing the fat.
He was just, yeah, he was talking about, one of the things that was funny about that was that he mentioned what editor he was working for, what office he was working out of. And he was saying to Tom, am I going to have any trouble with this guy getting my plots and everything? And Tom just said, don't worry about it, John. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure you have everything you need. And I was curious because I hadn't heard what Mr. Buscema was going to be working on. And I said, excuse me, sir, what are you doing out of that office? And he goes, oh, what's the name of it? The guy with the blue shirt. And I thought about it a second. I went, the Punisher? And he went, yeah, that's the...
Okay. That's a great description of the Punisher thing.
Yeah, guy in the blue shirt. That was John Buscema doing it. And those issues were incredibly cool.
I
loved seeing his stuff on the Punisher. I loved the work you did with Chuck Dixon on Punisher.
I mean, a writer I really like, actually, Chuck Dixon.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, Chuck does terrific stuff. I've had the opportunity to meet him. We have some mutual friends and... I mean, it's been an incredible career, you know. Mm. It's not over yet. But
I was going to say, it's not over yet, mate. No, I mean, obviously, we don't see you in Marvel anymore. No. But for a while, you did go, we've mentioned it already, you went over to DC for a little while and did the Superman. I mean, this is when he became like a being of energy, wasn't it? That sort of era. How did that come about? How did you, what instigated the move across to DC?
Well, it was instigated by dark raving fear and necessity. Marvel got to a point where, you know, things were not going great for them. Thunderstrike had been canceled along with a bunch of other books because Ron Perlman's people, Thunderstrike was actually selling quite well. So were a lot of other Marvel titles. But this was at a point when Ron Perlman, he's a businessman primarily.
Yeah. Asset stripper, I think is the term I've heard.
Yeah, he owned like Revlon or something.
Yeah,
like
that, he wasn't a comics guy, let's face it.
No, not a publishing guy either. And apparently what happened was, at one point, his people decided that they had this big meeting and Tom DeFalco was there, still in his position as editor-in-chief. Mm. And one of Ron Perlman's people made a presentation wherein they said, if we cancel half the Marvel line, the half that's left will sell twice as well. And Tom DeFalco laughed out loud at the absurdity of that.
Oh, it's crazy.
And then he went, oh my God, you're serious?
Oh.
And he realized right then that he was probably not going to be editor-in-chief for much longer.
He'd already sealed his fate.
And it turned out that was exactly the case.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were actually treating the books like they were cans of soup, you know?
Yeah. Just pure commodity.
Yeah, and Tom tried to explain to them, no. If somebody has a favorite title and you cancel it, they're not just going to necessarily find another title to love.
No.
They'll spend that money on a slice of pizza and a soda, you know, that kind of thing. They'll spend it on a movie or a video game. That you're playing a very dangerous game here.
Especially at that time, because video games were becoming a major thing then, weren't they? And obviously home, you know, VHS, I think, was the...
Sure.
And all that stuff, all different types of entertainment.
The collectible market was insane at the time. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as he said, this isn't stamped out product. This isn't, you know, these aren't easily replaceable cogs that you're talking about. Mm. These are, you know, creative endeavors that have very different personalities. And you're taking a real chance canceling books that are actually selling in the market. And cutting down for no real hope of return, you're also cutting Marvel's market share in half.
Yeah.
And he was told that his services as editor-in-chief were no longer necessary.
Why?
And they did that. They canceled Thunderstrike. They canceled a bunch of other books that were doing fine.
I remember. They used to cancel the stuff I liked. I remember that.
Oh, it was a huge implosion of everything.
Yeah.
And Marvel filed for bankruptcy under the Perlman regime.
Yeah, you know? I remember it well.
So anyway, so the contract that I had with Marvel at that point, I had gone on contract with Marvel during Thor and was happy as a clam on contract. and the contract carried over to Thunderstrike. And I was very happy on Thunderstrike, but then Thunderstrike is canceled for no real reason. And I'm at loose ends. And Mark Gruenwald, God love him. I mean, he was very much trying to run around sticking his thumb into holes in the wall, you know.
Yeah.
And trying to keep Marvel as much Marvel as possible. And it was impossible.
Yeah.
But I was in touch with Mark, and he, you know, he called. He said, Ron, I've really, really tried. There's nothing. I can't find anything to help you fill your contract quota. So the contract basically goes away. And I said, Mark, I said, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your efforts. I would have loved to have stayed a Marvel guy, if at all possible. I said, but I got a call from Mike Carlin over on the Superman books, because Brett Breeding and I had been friends for years.
Yeah.
Brett, of course, was over on the Superman books for years. And so he was able to mention to Mike, oh, by the way, Thunderstrike's been canceled. Mike Carlin is the type of guy that he would never poach working talent.
All right.
If you were producing for the other company, he would not approach you and try to make a better offer or outbid somebody or anything like that.
Mm.
But when he heard that I was at loose ends, apparently he had been interested. I mean, I had done a couple of Superman annuals for Mike.
Yeah.
Titano one and the one with Roger Stern where we introduced some of the Kirby concepts, reintroduced some of the Kirby.
Yeah, I remember that. That was nice, actually, that one.
It was fun doing. I mean, you know, I'm a comic book fan from way back. I started on DC's the same as everybody else, you know. I love the Superman and Batman and those characters. But I grew up on them. So Mike made the offer, and I said, okay, Mike, Mark Gruenwald is, and Mike Carlin had worked with Mark Gruenwald. He knew and respected Mark. Mm-hmm. I said, as soon as I hear from Mark, I will let you know. And when Mark called, I said, Mark, I don't want you to worry about me. I know you're worried about everybody, but you don't need to worry about me. I'm going to go say yes to Mike Carlin, and I've got somewhere to land. So that's what I did. And you couldn't ask for a better place to land.
It was pretty damn good, wasn't it? I mean, that was a high profile.
I was feeling very, very fortunate and very blessed. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that was that. I mean, those books sold pretty well, those Superman books, if I remember correctly.
They sold well. They were the biggest problem with the era that I came in on was that, you know, that McCarlin was no longer the line editor.
Right.
A lot of what really worked and a lot of what happened during those periods of times around the deaths and everything, the reason it worked as well as it did is because of Mike Carlin's blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Because
he could get the work out of the creative people. He knew how to ride herd on creative egos. Mm. And so once Mike was not steering the ship hands-on anymore, he had been promoted to like some kind of a managing editor, I believe.
Yeah.
And during my time on the books, we had a couple of different editors. But it was difficult because there was a certain amount of pressure from, you know, that was exerted on the creative people by themselves to try to maintain a certain level of popularity.
I mean, how do you follow, you know, Death of Superman?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there was always that, like, what's the next big thing? There were some ego clashes involved. There was some stuff going on behind the scenes that, you know, you can be a victim of your own success. And some of that was going on with those titles at the time.
Well, there's a lot of titles as well, wasn't there? I mean, was it five Superman titles running at the same time?
I believe it was the four monthly titles, and then they introduced Man of Tomorrow, which was a quarterly or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was.
And I'll tell you something. The gentleman that worked on those books, they called them the triangle titles because they came out weekly.
Yeah.
The guys who really put the time in on those books, the John Bogdanovs and the Dan Jurgenses and the Brett Breedingses and the Gary Gimmelses and all those guys, I have nothing but respect for those guys. That is a tough gig.
Yeah, because it was continuous, wasn't it?
You have no time at all to sit with a plot or, you know, sit with your thumbnails or percolate on anything. You have to produce because somebody is waiting to see your pages because their story picks up right where your story ends.
Yeah,
it was brutal, man. It was
brutal. I can imagine. And it must have been hard to make it all work as well. All those different creators, all those different titles, trying to tell a single arc. You know,
it was insane. I mean, so it burned out editors. I mean, I think it burned out Mike Carlin too.
Yeah,
best at it. But the two gentlemen that I worked with, I mean, they weren't enjoying themselves.
No,
it was a tough gig.
Oh, I
and I have to be honest. I mean, it was a lot of work. And you're talking to a guy that at that point was a 15, 20-year veteran of the business. You know, I had been in it for at least 12 or 13 years at that point, doing monthly comics. And on Thor, we would occasionally do bi-weekly during the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because you're quick, aren't you? You do. I mean, what's your rate? Do you churn out two pages a day?
It just depends on what's on the pages.
Yeah.
But the way I break down the work, if I have to, you know, I can produce relatively quickly. Yeah. Mm. That's always been a blessing in my professional life here. But I mean, again, working on the Superman gig taxed me. You know, I mean, it was tough. It was tough. You know, and then that kind of came to a bizarre ending too, because they decided they wanted to do a new character with the electric blue costume and everything. And they decided that it was fair to offer it to me. Well, you had asked how the electric blue stuff came along. They had decided the next arc they wanted to do was to basically prove that Superman is not just the power set.
Right.
There's more to Superman than the power set.
Yeah.
So they decided, well, let's tell a story where we change his powers and show that Superman is still Superman. You know, that kind of thing. And everybody on the books at the time was offered an opportunity. We were told that his powers were going to be electrical based and that his costume was going to basically become a containment suit.
Yeah.
So we were told those two things, and we were told that if you want to contribute some ideas, we'll be more than happy to see them. You know, if you have extra time, you want to put some time to it, go to it. And I was new on the books. I really wasn't planning on contributing anything, but I had this one idea that was kind of scratching at the back of my head. So I put it together and I sent it in along with the big names, you know, the Jerkins and the Bogdanovs and all those guys.
Yeah.
They ended up picking mine, which was a shock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that design, that is the blue and white design was my...
That was you. All right.
That was me.
And so how did the other guys feel that when it was your idea that was chosen?
They were all fairly supportive. I mean, yeah. I think that there's two reasons that my design was picked, and neither one of them are stunningly flattering. But, you know, one was that I was one of the only guys that messed with the S, which I think the sales department figured they could use, you know, because it still had the same outline.
Yeah.
You could tell the S was different.
Yeah.
And that was something they could use, like on watches and T-shirts and things like that. That would definitely say something different is happening.
You know?
And the other reason was that Glenn Whitmore, the colorist of the Superman line, that I'm now working with over at Sid Comics on Blue Baron.
Oh, yeah.
He, every Superman summit apparently would sit there and say, let's do Superman Red, Superman Blue. That imaginary story they did back in the 60s.
Right.
The first one where there was the Superman is split into two beings.
Yeah.
And Superman Red, Superman Blue. And being a colorist, he always said, let's do Superman Red, Superman Blue. And they always just kind of said, sure, Glenn, we'll do that someday. And so I think somebody decided that, you know, this might be an avenue.
The chance to do it.
Finally do Superman Red, Superman Blue.
Yeah.
And my design was all blue. So it was the easiest one to do all red.
Yeah.
Against it. And I think that's also one of the reasons I picked it.
Why? So it was almost like a matter of convenience for what they wanted to do.
I think it was one of those. You know, those were the two instances, the two facts that stacked the deck for me, and they decided on that. And I was as surprised as anybody, you know, that they.
Yeah.
And everybody I meet, because they want to be kind, they say, you know, no, I thought it was a great design. Just not, I didn't like it for Superman, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm going, I understand what you're saying. I know, believe me, I did not go on Spider-Man and ask for Spider-Man's costume to be changed. I did not go on the Mighty Thor and tell Tom, let's redesign Thor. That was Tom's idea.
Yeah. You're getting this reputation for being the guy who changes the costumes.
And I swear to you, Shane, I'm the guy who's sitting in the getaway car with the engine running. it is not my idea, but I'm the guy who's sitting there holding the bag when the cops show up. You know? So, yeah, it really isn't. It's not something I enjoy doing. You know?
I mean, the black costume, obviously, was very popular, wasn't it?
It was a huge success.
Once it came out,
you know, because you have to keep in mind this was before the internet and everything. So when the rumors started about Spider-Man getting his costume changed, everybody hated the idea.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. The fans were ready to, you know, light torches and storm the Marvel office. the mail was so negative before they saw it.
Yeah.
Jim Shooter went into Tom DeFalco's office and said, when are you introducing the black costume? And he said, in issue 252 of Spider-Man. And he said, okay, bring it in 252, get rid of it in 253.
Because really?
This thing is a dog. We're not going to survive this. And Tom said, Jim, we can't do that. He goes, what are you talking about? He said, we're introducing it in Spider-Man 252, but he doesn't get it until, like, what was it, issue 8 or 9?
Issue 8 of Secret Wars. Yeah.
Right. So we can't get rid of it in Amazing before it's introduced in Secret Wars. We got to play fair with the readers. So he has to hang on to it at least for the 8 issues. and Shooter couldn't fight that logic because it was spot on. Yeah. So he said, okay. So you keep it the month, the issue of Spider-Man that comes out the month after issue 8 of Secret Wars, get rid of it. He went, Jim, you're the boss. Okay. So that was the plan. Of course, once it appeared, everybody loved it. I did a couple of conventions in, one was up in Canada, actually, and the crowds were insane. Everybody thought that this book was going to be worth a fortune. And, you know, it was just nuts. The crowds were crazy.
It is a speculative book, isn't it? I mean, it 252, is, yeah. Secret Wars 8, they're both, yeah.
Yeah.
They fetch good money, don't they?
Well, to some degree, I guess. But, yeah. I mean, I don't know what good money is for a comic book these days. But, it was a whole different world. So we get to the end of those issues. We have those issues done. And again, we were dealing with snail mail. We weren't dealing with direct.
Yeah, it was different times. So things didn't, it wasn't so instant, was it? You know, people couldn't sort of criticize things, you know, on the day they're created, you know.
Right. That wasn't the case at all. Yeah. So what ended up happening was, you know, by the time we got to the story where he gets rid of it, where Tom DeFalco came up with the idea that it was a symbiote, and we did the story where Reed helps Pete get rid of it and all this kind of stuff. By the time we got around to that, it was very popular. Everybody loved it, which is why they ended up doing the story where Black Cat creates a cloth version of it because she likes the design.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. And we, you know, you're switching back and forth and everything. It was because of that kind of craziness, because of that lag time in audience reaction and everything. It was nuts.
Yeah.
It was, but yeah.
I remember even the second Spider-Woman had a sort of variation of the costume.
Well, and that, the way the story unfolded was that basically she had her costume first, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember how Secret Wars played out exactly, but yeah. I think she appears before Spider-Man gets the black suit. I think it's kind of suggested that the black suit was in. He saw her outfit and was kind of inspired
by it. Yeah, I seem to remember that. It
was designed by Mike Zeck for Secret Wars, and it was, and it was tweaked a little bit by Rick Leonardi. He did some photos before I came on Spider-Man as the regular. I did 252. He did 253 and 254.
Right.
And he put the extra little break in the legs that kind of made it look a little more organic.
Yeah.
A little less like racing stripes.
Yeah.
But, it was
great design. It's a great design because it's so simple. All the best designs are simple, aren't they?
But, you know, a lot of people say, well, that's got to be easier than drawing all those webs, right? Except more people draw the webs well than draw that white spider well. I'll tell you that. That white spider is not as easy as you think when you're messing with the breaks in the legs and everything.
Well, yeah, he's following the contours of the body, isn't it? So you could.
There's a lot of guys. There are a lot of guys that don't draw those legs well. Yeah.
No. Oh, you see it. They're sort of. Because they're drawing something two dimensional when they draw the legs, when really they should be following the contours of the body.
Where the breaks are and everything.
Yeah.
Nobody worries about that kind of reference. Back in the day, we were all working off the same reference.
Yeah.
They don't worry about that kind of stuff now. Our comic books have become art. Back in the day, back in the 80s up through the 90s, there was an element of commercial product to be in comics. There was an objective standard to what a good comic book was. But now it's art. Now you're expressing yourself. So nobody requires you to draw Captain America, you know, from a style guide. Nobody expects you to draw Spider-Man this, you know, in a consistent way, because you're not worried about it in the same way you were back in the day, you know. So it's become a much more subjective industry because of that.
Would you say there's less discipline?
Of that kind of discipline? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as like the head down discipline, this is what the character looks like.
Yeah.
Don't draw him differently. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, and it has nothing to do, you know, I'll be honest with you. When Disney purchased Marvel, I was thinking, you know what, maybe we'll get back to some of that kind of discipline because certainly they don't let people draw Mickey Mouse however the hell they want. I mean, they have model sheets for Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
But they don't, you know, Disney really, Marvel is just one of many things they own, and I don't get the impression that there's a Disney representative stalking the halls of Marvel, making sure they do things.
I think now Kevin Feige, who does the films, is actually running the comics as well,
that's
isn't
it? That's what I've heard, but I'm sure that's at a much higher level than I've ever.
I'm thinking, is that just at a very high level where it's not so hands-on, maybe?
I don't think he has an office.
Yeah.
I don't think he has an office at the Marvel publishing.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. I mean, DC's moved out to California, too, so they have...
Yeah. I mean, it's all very different now, isn't it? You know, it's all very centered around, well, there's lots of things going on that have changed, you know, superhero comics.
But a lot of it now, as far as where the real money is, centers around the intellectual property, centers around the IP of these characters. And Marvel Films has had a lot to do with that, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, I mean, I've had my name turn up on a couple of Marvel films, and I've received a couple of very generous checks based on, you know, silly stuff that I've contributed to the Marvel myth, you know, that kind of thing.
I mean, it's pretty cool, I guess, that they're at least crediting and paying artists and writers for when they take something from you've created.
You know? I think they're trying to stay fair.
I mean,
you know, I kind of cynically call it the please don't sue us check, you know, that kind of thing. But the bottom line is, you know, if you're creating for Marvel in good faith, then you understand that the company owns all that stuff.
Yeah.
But they're not obligated to do that. I mean, you know, a lot of people will talk about the morality of it and all this, and that's all well and good. And, you know, I try to be a moral person, and that would be great if corporations acted that way. But the bottom line is nobody's requiring them to act that way. So the fact that they're doing anything is kind of cool. You know, I'll give them what little credit they deserve for credit due. You know.
Yeah. No, I agree with that point of view, to be honest, because like you say, they don't have to give anyone anything, do they?
Right.
So anything that they do give out is, like you say, it could be sort of like we're doing this as a damage limitation thing, but at the end of the day, I think it's a good thing. And I love to see all the names of the artists and the writers on the screen when I go and see one of those movies.
Well, yeah, I actually, when I received the check, the thing we got a check for was in Ant-Man and the Wasp, and in the Avengers, because we named Hank Pym's daughter Hope. In the MC2 books, in A Next, she was a villain, but in the MC2 books, Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne had two kids, they had twins. And the one was Hank Jr. One twin was Hank Jr. and the other twin was Hope. His daughter's name was Hope, and she became a character called the Red Queen. And as I said, was a villain. But when they decided in the Ant-Man movie to do the two generation thing and have Hank Pym, and then also have Scott Lang, and to have Hank Pym have a daughter, rather than just make up their own, they had somebody Google it. And, you know, and they said, does Hank Pym have a daughter in the comics? And I went, well, we find something here that says, yeah, he has a daughter named Hope. Okay, we'll use Hope. And they used Hope. And because of that, Tom DeFalco and I got a check. And I got a phone call from some Marvel higher up. I forget the gentleman's name. But he called. And he was actually, I thanked him. And I thought it was wonderful, but I said exactly what I just said to you about, you know, it's nice that somebody bothered to Google it, you know. That And he, I think I got the impression he was a little offended that I wasn't taking it more seriously. You know, and I said, no, believe me, I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. I grew up with, you know, what we had on TV then. That wasn't respecting the source material at all. So,
it was very different, wasn't it?
You know? Very different world. And I don't expect much. You know, when the first X-Men movie came out and I saw a picture of Hugh Jackman and they actually bothered to give him the Wolverine hair, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
That was a big surprise for me as well.
Yeah. So, you know, because I grew up in a very different time. But anyway, you know, so, I mean, it was... Like I said, I really appreciated it. And we even got the credit. There are people that think that Tom and I got the credit in Avengers Endgame because of Captain America picking up the hammer.
Right.
I don't believe that. I believe we got the credit. The only reason we got the credit, everybody got a credit in Endgame.
Yeah, well, everyone was in Endgame, weren't they?
Exactly. All the characters were in it, so everybody that got credit in any of the other character movies had to get a credit. So I think it's just because Hope was in there, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Although I remember Cap picking up the hammer was in, was it in the Thunderstrike series or the Thor series?
It was Thor. Yeah, it was in Thor. It was actually Brett Breeding's idea.
Yeah.
He was inking the book at the time, and we were having a conversation where he said, you know, if anybody would be able to pick up the hammer besides Beta Ray Bill, you'd think it'd be Steve Rogers, you know. And I kind of went, hmm. And I bounced the idea off at DeFalco, and DeFalco went, hmm. So, you know, we did the scene. The captain at the time and everything.
Yeah, he's a captain.
That was the first time he did it, but it wasn't the only time.
No, so, but I remember reading that as a young, I won't say a kid, sort of a young adult probably. But I remember reading that and having shivers when Cap picked up the hammer. You know, it was like a recognition of what Cap was.
Sure. And, I mean, we had a lot of fun with it. We kind of we always hedge our bets. Tom DeFalco always tends to hedge his bets. You know, I mean, was Thor summoning the hammer? Is Cap really worthy enough to wield? I mean, is he worthy enough to wield it? Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. And we've always kind of played fast and loose with that. Other writers, not so much. I mean, they've had Cap using the hammer in the books before the movie came along.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was a terrific scene, but I didn't see the movie for the first couple of weeks, and people were saying, "Oh, you really should see that movie. There's a scene in there you're really going to like." And I kind of, from what the way they were saying it, I kind of figured out what it was.
Yeah.
And I said, but wait a minute. Do they do the scene the way we did it in Thor? Mm. Well, no. And I said, well, what makes you think they got it from us? You know, I mean, it is what it is. You know?
Yeah, you could say it's a logical conclusion, couldn't you?
To a certain degree. I think great minds think alike. You know, every you can't claim, it's hard to claim an idea like that. In the first Avengers movie, when they showed the go to the helicarrier and they think they're just on an aircraft carrier.
Oh yeah.
It lift out of the water. We were the first ones to do that in a Hercules miniseries that nobody saw.
Yeah, I got that series. I'm sure I got that series. Yeah. That was the first Hercules series, wasn't it?
It was a 3-issue thing
we did
where he fights Ares and all this.
Yeah. But
he works with SHIELD and it showed the helicarrier coming up out of the water. And because that was an idea that I thought was really cool. I mean, because how do you land this thing? The way it's designed, the only place you could land it would be in the water.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So we did the scene. And then when it showed up in the movie, I was told that, no, in the meantime, they had done it in like, what did they call the Avengers book that was in the Ultimates.
The Ultimates. Yeah.
It seemed like that in the Ultimates.
Yeah. So I mean, they took a lot from those books, actually, for the movies.
Right. So it's much more likely that either they saw it from the Ultimates or Joss Whedon came up with it himself. You know, they saw it in that Hercules miniseries, which, like I said, nobody saw that Hercules.
It's pretty obscure.
Unfortunately, it kind of fell between the cracks because it was during Heroes. What was where all the heroes disappeared to be done by the Image guys? What was that called?
Heroes Reborn, wasn't it? Yeah, because they all it was a different universe, wasn't it?
Well, they went to a different universe.
Yeah.
So the whole premise of this miniseries was that SHIELD was looking to weaponize what heroes were left because they had lost so much. So they contacted Hercules, and Hercules worked with SHIELD for a few issues.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, so I think, you know, ideas are not exclusive, you know, a lot of creative people can have the same idea.
Yeah.
Without filing lawsuits and there's no way you didn't see my idea, because of course there's a way.
So now we go to sort of present day. What are you working on at the moment, Ron?
Well, I am working for an outfit out of California called Sit Comics, which, of course, the name is based on sitcoms because the gentleman who runs it, Darren Henry, cut his teeth working as a sitcom writer and producer And he's been doing that for years, and he is a comic book fan from the 70s, and he loved comics and wanted to take a crack at it. It started out with this one idea he had that, you know, he had a couple of ideas that he had pitched as possible sitcoms that weren't picked up, and he decided he would do them in a graphic novel type of a form, but it quickly expanded into an entire line of books, both humor titles and superhero titles. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm doing a title called The Blue Baron. Currently I'm working on a second title for him called The Heroes Union, which is kind of his you know, Avengers Justice League grouping of heroes. And some very creative characters. He has a terrific modern voice, but he still loves traditional superheroes. And most of the titles are, you know, classic superhero setups with like some kind of a sitcom tweak.
Right.
In the case of the Blue Baron, it's kind of superhero meets Freaky Friday.
Right.
There's like a body exchange between the hero and a 14-year-old kid. And so it's a lot of fun. It's, you know,
it's playing on some tropes then that, you know.
Oh, it's classic superhero tropes with a twist.
Yeah.
Basically how he's selling all of these things. Yeah. And they're terrific. I mean, and humor books are very good. So, I mean, check, it's a sitcomics.net.
Okay.
I believe the titles are available on Comixology, the Comixology website, and they're available for order of hard copies. They're available in some shops. I don't know if they're available in.
We don't see them much here in the UK.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're in the UK yet, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's been a slow build, but they're going to be available through Diamond soon.
Right.
So if that helps, that would be the way to get it too. So, but as I said, they are available digitally and are packaged digitally as well. So they're well worth checking out. If you're a fan of Marvel's, you know, the Silver Age stuff and into the 70s and the early 80s, that's very much the vibe he's going for.
That's my bag.
He's got Roger Stern working for him.
Why?
He's got Dave Michelinie working for him. He's got Todd DeZago working for him. Plus, he's a very, very talented writer in his own right.
Yeah.
He's got me. He's got Pat Brousseau. No, I'm sorry. Oh, I just said a name that has nothing to do with anything. But he does. He has, you know, he's gotten some terrific talent put together.
And I'll be checking it out, definitely, because, I mean, that's the period of comics that I love, you know.
Well, I think you'll enjoy them then. You know, yeah, definitely when Heroes Union comes out, get a hold of it. And when there's three issues of Blue Baron already out that I'll be curious to see, you know, when you finally check them out, touch base with me on private.
I will. Definitely, yeah. I mean, if I can't get them here in the UK for any reason, what I'll probably do is check them out on Comixology or something like that. I'm not a big fan of reading comics digitally. I do love the whole tactile nature of reading comics.
Yeah, I have yet to adapt to anything involving the computer. The fact that I'm talking to you on a computer, I may as well be a monkey man standing in front of the Black Obelisk, believe me.
Well, you did a pretty good job.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Well, I have kept you for quite a while now, actually, Ron, so I won't keep you much longer. But I did want to just say, again, thank you very much for joining me tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. It really has.
It's been a great pleasure for me too, Shane.
Oh, thank you.
I love comics. I love the fact that I got to do comics, so I'm always willing to talk about it.
Oh, it's been great. It's been great reminiscing as well when you've been talking about, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man and the Thor run. It's taken me back, you know, to some very happy memories. So thank you for that.
I'm really happy. That touches my heart. I one of the things I've discovered from being on Facebook is that it's not about me. It's about the personal nostalgia. I have been blessed to become part of people's personal nostalgia. You know, I am somehow, I have magically become a part of happy childhood memories. And you can't beat that.
Oh,
you
know, no.
You cannot beat that. That is a gift from on high. So I feel like a very, very fortunate man.
It's well deserved, mate. It's well deserved. You've worked really hard and produced some amazing work. So thank you for that. Okay, well, I'm gonna let you have your evening. And I'm gonna go and have something to eat. Thank you again, and hopefully, you know, we'll speak again in the future.
I would look forward to it. I had a great time. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye-bye.